is nowhere.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 628. Me and Jason today, and we are going to tackle the history of mind control. I guess we should open by asking, is your mind your own? And actually, you might be surprised. But anyhow, welcome, Jason.
And a rather lovely good morning.
I wish I could say the same. We're looking at day after day after day of rain, and I cannot use my telescope. So it's a long, hard wait for good weather sometimes.
We're supposed to be getting lots of rain here in southern Louisiana.
Well, I did get the herb garden and everything planted, so the rain's doing that some good. But let's jump in here.
Mind control, which has also been called brainwashing, coercive persuasion, or thought control, means trying to control other people's behaviors and beliefs. While doing so, a person or group attempts to persuade others to change their basic beliefs and values, oftentimes with an attempt to add in new forms of beliefs and values. Unethical methods and manipulation might be, and often are, employed to accomplish this goal, which often ends up harming the people who are being manipulated. The term has been applied to any tactic which damages an individual's control over their own thinking, behavior, emotions, or decision-making.
The sad truth is that there are major portions of our so-called culture, and we don't really have a culture. Most of what we call culture is designed through entertainment, a lot of it. But much of what we're about to cover and certain methods of mind control use some very simple tactics. One of the basic tactics used is repetition. Now consider our music. If you go back to a time when people actually had to get educated and study hard to understand music theory and all the things that go with it, it is very complex. The music they made was very complex. The music was generally back then delivered to you in frequencies that were sometimes called green frequencies or Verde frequencies. This is before we went to 440, which was an intentional jacking up of those green frequencies. As a matter of fact, they made two or three runs at it right before World War II, mind you, and they implemented the changeover, and they had to keep it hidden from, I think it was France, because no one there was going for it. But to get back to the point, consider the music we have now and compare it to even something like Beethoven, which isn't that long ago, by the way. What we have now is repetition. And, you know, you can ask Jason. Jason, when you meet other musicians, how often, like, I'm not even going to answer the question because I think you will answer it. If you sit down with musicians you don't know and you want to play something together, not knowing what songs you know, what they know, what do you almost always go to?
It'd be a blues jam.
Yeah, exactly. 12-bar blues, almost always. And it's astonishing how much of rock and roll is built around 12-bar blues. But here's my point. If you take a song like, what's the guy's name who did Werewolf of London? Warren Zevon. That song, if I'm not mistaken, and I don't think I am, but maybe I might be off a little bit here. There's no chorus. There's no anything. It is the same riff over and over and over. And much of the music we grew up on is based on this repetition. And I think it's by design, because in mind control, repetition is one of the things that sets the foundation for changing minds. And it doesn't take a genius to look at the news. How many times have you seen someone take news from every city in the country and they are literally verbatim saying the same words? Repetition. My main point here is the majority of the music that we call pop culture is based around the foundations of mind control.
The rise of mesmerism in the late 18th and early 19th centuries that was spearheaded by Franz Anton Mesmer and his followers demonstrates the early attempts at some form of mind control. Franz Mesmer lived from 1734 until 1815 and was an Austrian physician. He introduced his theory of animal magnetism in the 1770s, with it gaining significant traction in Europe, especially France, by the early 1800s. Mesmer posited that an invisible, universal fluid coursed through all living beings, which influenced health and behavior. Mesmer put forth that imbalances in this fluid caused illness, and he claimed that he could manipulate it to heal patients using techniques like hand gestures, magnetic objects, and intense eye contact. His sessions would often induce trance-like states in his patients. These might be marked by convulsions, fainting, or deep relaxation, phenomena he attributed to the realignment of this fluid.
You know, it's astonishing how much misinformation and denial are around what Mesmer was involved in, specifically animal magnetism. For those of you who are familiar with James Shelby Downard, go look at that. He hooks up what he calls animal magnetism to ley lines and all the other things to do the hocus pocus magic that Downard was so brilliant at covering. But in this, I just don't think people realize how often these tactics are brought to bear. Here's one example. Guy's out selling books and he's not doing so well. He's informed if you do this one simple thing, it'll make your sales skyrocket. You can probably look this up to confirm it. And it's a very simple thing, but it has been shown time and time again to work. What you do is you pose a question and then you answer your own question with "buy my book." And time and again, when it was measured what they were selling before this was implemented and after, it's like hundreds of percent increase in sales just for simply saying things like, "Well, do you want to know how you can prevent yourself from being hypnotized? Buy my book." I mean, that's pretty simple and basic, but I'm telling you, look it up. It works.
By the 1780s, Mesmer had moved to Paris, where his theatrical demonstrations had captivated the public as well as the aristocracy. Patients were instructed to sit around baquets, which were wooden tubs filled with magnetized water and iron rods, and holding hands or rods as Mesmer, who was dressed in a flowing robe, waved wands or stared into their eyes. These rituals were said to frequently produce dramatic psychological effects, such as hysteria, calmness, or apparent cures. This is significant as it suggests that suggestion and expectation could profoundly alter mental states. In 1784, a French royal commission, which included Benjamin Franklin, investigated Mesmer's claims and dismissed animal magnetism as a physical force, attributing the effects to imagination and suggestion. This did debunk Mesmer's scientific basis, but it inadvertently highlighted the power of the mind to be influenced, which foreshadowed later mind control concepts. After Mesmer's death in 1815, his ideas didn't fade. Instead, they evolved. In the early 19th century, his followers, who became known as Mesmerists, set about refining his techniques. They stripped away the mystical fluid theory and focused on the psychological mechanisms at play. This shift birthed modern hypnotism, a term that would be coined by a Scottish surgeon, James Braid, in 1841.
Okay, a couple of things. This has been downplayed so much, and we can use this example to show how popular and what a big deal it was at the time. If you meet someone who's dazed and confused, what do you say? They're mesmerized. Well, that word's pulled from this man's name, and I would put forward for a word to be created and put into our lexicon, it must have been a pretty big deal. But one thing I noticed for certain is it seems like almost everything to do with magnetism, whether it's like this kind of occulty ideas or general mechanics and other things, has been downplayed and obscured, and everything electrical and things to do with electricity have been promoted. But from one of my top five books, one of my top five favorite books, The Diary of a Yogi, which was written by a man named Yogananda, who was high up in what I'll call the mind sciences that were based, I don't know, for millennia in India. He actually talks a little bit about hypnotism in that book, and he says you should never let anyone hypnotize you, and it's described why. And I think that's a big deal, because what I notice is if you study the so-called yogis and the people into what I call absolute mind science, which is people like Yogananda, his guru, and many others all around the world, not just in India, they are going in a very different direction with all these ideas, and it's always spiritually based. And when we see hypnotism and other things, it's the opposite. It's going in the other direction. And I think that Yogananda was correct in warning people not to let people into their minds.
In 1886, Sigmund Freud began laying the groundwork for psychoanalysis in Vienna, which was a development that revolutionized the understanding of the human mind, as well as its potential for manipulation. This marked a significant shift from the earlier and less scientific approaches, like mesmerism, to a more structured psychological framework that sought to uncover and influence unconscious thoughts through talk therapy. Sigmund Freud, who lived from 1856 to 1939, was a young neurologist when he returned to Vienna in 1886 after studying in Paris under Jean-Martin Charcot. Charcot's work on hysteria and hypnosis was deeply influencing Freud, exposing him to the idea that mental states could be altered and that unconscious processes drove behavior. Once back in Vienna, Freud would open a private practice and begin to experiment with techniques to access and influence the mind, initially building on hypnosis before he began a pivot to talk therapy.
In my mind, nothing good has come from this, all the way up to modern psychology. And what I'm about to say may upset some people, but I'm sorry. It's the way that I feel about it. If you look at what psychiatry has become, they're basically drug peddlers. I saw an interview recently where someone was covering the field of psychology and they interviewed some people high up, and I think it was maybe New York City, and they asked two simple questions. How many people have you cured? And every one of them said the same thing, none. And they said, what are the chief things that you do for your patient? And every one of them said the same thing. They push drugs, but what's so bad about it is they don't even really know the effects of the drug, and they admit openly that they have to experiment to try to hit on what they feel is correct. But if we're going to be honest here, Jason, let's draw the line. So here we are at what most Western people would say is the beginning of the hacking the mind psychology sciences. Who was this man's double nephew, and what did he use this information for, Jason? You wrote all the notes for it.
Well, that would be a man named Edward Bernays.
You know, F and A. Can we think of any man in all the episodes that we've done that changed America more than Bernays? I don't think we can. I mean, it's astonishing when you begin to look at Bernays. And how is it that he could be, it's pointed out over and again that he's the double nephew of Freud. So do you suppose he was applying to marketing what his uncle was up to? And when you take it apart, and that's the very beginnings of big time marketing in this country, I would estimate, what does that tell you that marketing is? Marketing is basically mind manipulation, isn't it? What marketing does is tries to get a person to do a thing they would not have done otherwise, and at no time is telling the truth or being accurate a concern of marketers.
Bernays took the techniques developed by his uncle Siggy and applied them to great effect and much success to his business of being a public relations counselor. And those techniques are still being used today.
You know, I hadn't thought of it, but if I'm not mistaken, you'll probably remember, wasn't Bernays's second language English? Didn't he speak German first or Austrian, which I think is the same, isn't it?
I'm not entirely certain if he spoke English or German first.
Well, I think I remember that. But even if I'm wrong there, I think it's safe to say that Freud primarily spoke a Germanic language. And the only reason I'm bringing it up is because I've read on many accounts that the best language in the universe, in the known universe for engineering of any kind, is German. And I mean, who's going to argue with how great the engineering has been out of Germany?
I just looked it up. It looks like his primary language was English because he moved to the United States as a child and grew up in an English-speaking environment.
Okay, so I did make a mistake on him, but I'm pretty sure he was bilingual, though.
I would think that he would have to be.
I remembered it wrong, but anyhow, the uncle did in fact speak German. I'm just drawing the line that basically what we're talking about is, you know, mind engineering, where you're trying to come up with ways to hack the human mind.
Around 1886 to 1889, Freud began his transition from hypnosis to what he would later call the talking cure. Freud was attempting to deal with patients' symptoms through hypnotic suggestion, but he was growing frustrated with the limitations of hypnosis as some patients resisted trance, with results being inconsistent. Freud, more and more, began encouraging his patients to speak freely about their thoughts, their memories, and their dreams, which was a method that Joseph Breuer, an Austrian physician and physiologist whose work significantly influenced the development of psychology and psychoanalysis, had stumbled upon with a patient with the pseudonym Anna O. This free association sought to bypass conscious defenses and reveal unconscious material. By the late 1880s and 1890s, Freud had fully developed psychoanalysis, moving beyond hypnosis and into a method that relied on verbal exchange, interpretation, and the therapeutic relationship. Freud's intent was, of course, therapeutic, as he was trying to help patients overcome neuroses. However, his methods and insights revealed the mind's susceptibility to external influence, which prefigured later coercive applications.
In other words, they're starting to crack the door on how to hack the human mind. And, you know, think about what we're saying here. All this time ago, late 1800s, they're starting supposedly at this time to figure out how the brain works, how it can be manipulated, all these things which are going to be put to use at a later date. But what's come of it? You know, I opened with that idea. What do psychiatrists do now? How do we even allow psychiatry to be respected when basically admitted by some of the top people in their field, nobody gets cured, and the primary thing they do is push drugs, and they're not sure about what the effect of that's going to be. To me, it almost seems, well, I'm not even going to go there because I'll get too much poison pen mail. Go ahead, Jason.
Moving into the beginning of the 20th century, the Russian physiologist Ivan Pavlov begins his famous experiments around 1901, with his key findings being published and refined through the 1910s and 1920s. While studying digestion in dogs, Pavlov noticed that they salivated not just when food was being presented, but when they were anticipating it, such as when they heard the footsteps of the lab assistant bringing the food. This sparked Pavlov's exploration of what he called conditioned reflexes. Pavlov would pair a neutral stimulus, like the sound of a metronome or bell, with an unconditioned stimulus, such as the food, that naturally triggered a response, in this case, the salivation. After repeated pairings, the dogs began to salivate at the sound alone, even without the food. This new response was what he called the conditioned reflex. Pavlov found that behavior could be shaped by associating stimuli in a predictable and repeatable way. The dogs' reactions weren't conscious decisions, but automatic responses that were wired into their nervous systems through repetition. By the 1920s, Pavlov would expand his work to explore how conditioning could be extinguished, like removing the food association, or generalized, such as the dogs responding to similar sounds. Pavlov also studied how stress or overstimulation could disrupt these reflexes, which hinted at the limits of behavioral control. While Pavlov's findings didn't directly address thoughts or free will, they did reveal how external triggers could bypass conscious choice to alter behavior. This leap from physiology to psychology became a stepping stone for mind control concepts that would be used in the coming years, not just on animals, but on human beings as well.
I mean, there's an underlying obvious statement we've got to make here, right? If you're going to do things like Pavlov did, we can ask the question, are you being a decent human being? Maybe. I mean, to me, you're right up to the line. And what's this all based on? Repetition. Remember what I said about our music? In a way, we're all Pavlov's dogs just by dint of our music. But to get back to the point, if you're going to try to apply these things to control someone else's mind, you're not being a decent human being anymore, which means that the majority of what we're about to cover is going to find most of its use in places where they're not going to openly admit what they're doing, and to be honest, is probably not respectable in the first place.
In 1920, John B. Watson an American psychologist and founder of behaviorism, aimed to prove that human behavior wasn't just a product of internal thoughts or instincts, but something that could be shaped entirely by external stimuli. At Johns Hopkins University, Hopkins and his graduate assistant, Rosalie Rayner, conducted what is the now infamous Little Albert experiment. The subject of the experiment was Albert B., a 9-month-old infant, who was described as healthy and emotionally stable and had no prior fear of animals. Watson first showed Albert a white rat, which the baby initially liked, reaching out to touch it, which is a neutral stimulus. Then, Watson paired the rat's appearance with a loud, jarring noise by striking a steel bar with a hammer behind Albert's head. This is an unconditioned stimulus, which naturally caused distress and crying, an unconditioned response. After several pairings of the rat and the noise, Albert began crying and recoiling at the sight of the rat alone, even without the sound being heard. This is a conditioned response, and the fear had been successfully conditioned. Watson tested Albert with similar objects, such as rabbits, a dog, a fur coat, even a Santa Claus mask with a white beard, and found that the fear extended to these, showing that emotional responses could spread beyond the original trigger. Albert's fear had been artificially implanted through repetition and not rational understanding. The experiment ended abruptly when Albert's mother withdrew him, with Watson never having deconditioned him, which left his long-term fate unclear.
Do we even want to know what deconditioning would be like? Although I guess we can probably guess. Probably involves a rat without noise, but I mean, this is what I'm talking about. Here's where human decency flees the scene. And here's where respected men in white lab coats, respected by our culture, because we've been trained to be in awe of science and respect the men in the white lab coats and listen to what they have to say, are doing things that are unacceptable. And we close out by saying Albert's mother apparently came to her senses and withdrew her child. Well, I got news for you, mother. You weren't being a very good mother when you let a 9-month infant become somebody's plaything to supposedly further science. But this is permanent damage. And as far as deconditioning, I'm not going to mention it, but really the damage has been done with a 9-year-old infant. Whether or not they can decondition him, you're learning everything at that age. And most of the things you learn when you were young stick with you for a good part of your life. The main point here is this is one of the main issues with psychology. They're not being decent human beings, and they always take it too far. And before we're done here, we'll show examples of taking it way too far.
One could say that the decade of the 1930s were ripe for psychological manipulation, with the Great Depression leaving people feeling desperate and disillusioned. Two huge technological inventions also became normalized in Western society, with radio and film both emerging as powerful new media. Totalitarian regimes in Germany and the Soviet Union seized this moment in time, building on earlier behavioral science, like the previously mentioned Pavlov and Watson, with wartime propaganda from World War I being used to refine their methods of manipulation. Both Goebbels in Nazi Germany and Stalin in the Soviet Union understood that controlling perception of the masses was as crucial as controlling resources.
This is kind of the narrow, one-minded nonsense we get in America. The big example here are these terrible totalitarian regimes, Germany and the Soviet Union. I would put forward that you want TV and radio manipulation, the king of that is America. Nowhere to be mentioned here. But I mean, come on. The minute that they got to radio, I am convinced they knew the power of what they were about to wield, mass communication. As I've mentioned so many times in the movie, Brother, Wherefore Art Thou? They're about to electrify for the first time a whole area of the United States. Incumbent senator comes to the radio station and his son says to him, look, daddy, there's some constituents. Let's go press the flesh. And he smacks him and says, you idiot, we are mass communicating here. So in the same way they knew the power, you know, from ancient Greek in the amphitheater, they knew darn well that it was about to get a lot more powerful with radio, and even more so when they added imagery with television. I just think it's laughable that we always grab the, you know, the villain states to make the example, when I don't think anyone has surpassed propaganda use with entertainment more than the United States.
Joseph Goebbels was Adolf Hitler's Minister of Propaganda in Nazi Germany. From 1933, he turned mind manipulation into a very dark art form, with his goal not being just to inform, but to reprogram how Germans thought about themselves, their enemies, and the Nazi state. Goebbels famously said, "If you repeat a lie often enough, it becomes the truth." Slogans like "One People, One Empire, One Leader" were drilled into public consciousness via speeches, posters, and, of course, the ever-pervasive radio. Nazi rallies paired symbols like the swastika and militaristic uniforms with euphoria, pride, and unity, while anyone considered an outsider were linked to fear and disgust. This was often done through relentless vilification in German films and other media, since the regime controlled all of the newspapers, radio, and cinema. The 1935 film Triumph of the Will glorified Adolf Hitler, a film which conditioned viewers to see him as infallible. Public executions and the Gestapo's omnipresence reinforced strict compliance, with the knowledge that if you disobey, you would vanish. Goebbels' approach echoed Pavlov's conditioning, with pairing a stimulus, this time being Nazi ideals, with a reward, which was belonging and safety. The opposite was also true, of course, with the terror of punishment being the alternative. Over time, resistance in the captive German state eroded as the population internalized the endless Nazi narrative. All of this was done without forcing belief through any sort of logic, but shaping reflexes to cheer at the Führer's voice and recoil at their enemies. This mass-scale emotional engineering prefigured later mind control goals of bypassing rational thought.
Well, in our era, you can still jump on places like YouTube and look up some of the speeches and see them translated. And it occurs to me that there really is a difference between how it's being used in supposed Nazi Germany. It's in your face. And I guess the iron fist is what's backing the acceptance of it, where here in the country where I grew up, much of it for decades is going on, but nobody's aware of it. But let me make the big point here. So I believe it was the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds that got Goebbels involved in the frequency change for music, the standard tuning for concert A. Do you agree with that? It was Goebbels, right, Jason?
Should have been.
Yeah, pretty sure. So anyhow, they put this guy pre-World War II. They make a couple, two, three runs. I don't remember. I do remember that they had to hide it from France, because there were so many serious musicians that were having none of it and considered 440 to be a damaging frequency. Nonetheless, they get 440 put in. Now, with everything Jason just read about World War II and supposed evil Ministry of Propaganda, you see what happened here. They took the Verdi tuning for all these forms of music and communication and radio and everything else, and they jammed 440 down the pipe. And anyone now can probably look up what 440 is about, but the older tunings were thought to be harmonious and nurturing, whereas 440 was the exact opposite. So you can see the cue up, and I think it's openly admitted now that it was Rockefeller, Rothschild that were behind the Goebbels involvement in the frequency change.
In Soviet Russia, Stalin's regime, which began in 1924, wielded propaganda to forge a unified Soviet man, one which was loyal to communism and to the state. While it was done less theatrically than the Nazis, it was equally pervasive and still as ruthless. The cult of personality that was around Stalin, with portraits everywhere and constant praise in the Soviet state newspaper Pravda, hammered home his godlike status. Slogans like "Stalin is the Lenin of today" linked him to the previous revolutionary glory. The Great Purge, that occurred from 1936 through 1938, saw millions arrested and/or executed, which created a climate where dissent was known to mean death was a certainty. Public show trials conditioned citizens to equate questioning the state with betrayal. Soviet films, works of literature, and radio broadcasts glorified workers and demonized class enemies. History was rewritten, with Trotsky being airbrushed from photos to control the collective memory. Propaganda promised a utopian future, pairing loyalty with hope, a high example being the five-year plans that were hyped as collective triumphs. Stalin's system leaned on Watson's emotional conditioning: associate the party with security and pride, and dissent with terror. The goal was a population that didn't just obey, but felt the ideology as the absolute truth. The erasure of alternative narratives, events that were constantly occurring via censorship and purges, mirrored later mind control experiments aiming to depattern subjects, meaning to wipe the slate clean and implant a new reality.
I think I could give you an example of exactly what you just explained about supposed Soviet Russia now, but to get back to the point, there was also a whole color and design mind control thing going on. If you go look at how much red was put into all the communications posters and so many things, and as we know, colors have frequency and intent and all that, but also look at the architecture. It's all very bleak and overwhelmingly in your face. But to get back to the point, they're talking about erasing things. It's like from 1984, the memory hole or whatever it is. But check this out. When I was doing research for the last episode, and I've mentioned this on the air a few times, when my YouTube channel got whacked in the fall of 2017 for censorship because Jason and I had covered the Mandalay Bay hoax, I saw the cover of Wired magazine in the office of one of the guys that was helping me at that time do my website. And I've referenced it a couple times. I tried to find it. I can't. And so I pinged Rose and said, "Rose, between 2015 and 2017, and I thought it was like maybe 2016, 17, there was a cover where Wired magazine openly announced censorship, which is another form of what we're talking about here, by the way, and she couldn't find it. So I'm here to tell you, it appears that they are scrubbing the censorship announcements behind us. If I am correct, and I know I saw it, on the cover was the announcement that censorship had arrived. If anyone can find that or know something about it, I'd love to hear from you.
On the eve of Halloween 1938, Orson Welles and his Mercury Theater on the Air aired an adaptation of H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds on CBS Radio. The episode was framed as a series of faux news bulletins that were interrupting a music program to report on a Martian invasion taking place in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. The broadcast began with a brief introduction that noted that it was a work of fiction, but many listeners missed this rather important point, either tuning into the broadcast late or happened to be flipping through channels. What they heard came across as chillingly realistic: bulletins that described Martian cylinders landing, heat rays incinerating towns, and military forces crumbling. All of this was delivered in a deadpan, authoritative tone by actors who were posing as reporters and officials, sounding just like if the event were actually transpiring and being reported on. Panic, of course, erupted as a result of the misunderstanding. Listeners in New Jersey and beyond flooded police stations with urgent calls, grabbed their guns, or fled their homes. Estimates vary, but some claim that over 1 million people believed that the invasion was real, although later studies suggest that the scale was exaggerated by sensational headlines at the time. The realism stemmed from radio's credibility as a news medium in 1938, the lack of disclaimers mid-broadcast, and the tense worldwide context as World War II loomed not very far in the future. Needless to say, people were primed for catastrophe. Orson Welles later apologized and claimed that there was no intent to deceive. Regardless, the fallout revealed a startling vulnerability in the public psyche. The War of the Worlds incident isn't publicly claimed to be a calculated attempt at mind control, but it certainly demonstrated principles that are central to manipulating perception and behavior on a mass scale. The broadcast absolutely showed how quickly a group could be convinced of a fabricated reality if the delivery mimicked what were considered trusted sources. Listeners didn't question the news, and they reacted viscerally as a result, running or hiding from the perceived drastic threat.
I'm calling poppycock. This was intended. This was another mind job. They were running a test to see what would happen. I've always had problems with Orson Welles, and of course, he's a big guy in Hollywood. Of course, he made the movie that's regularly voted the best of all time, which does what? It shows you what had become of media way, way back in our history, how it was just being owned, operated, and controlled, and they could make up wars if they wanted to. But he was in his early 20s when he was starting to get free reign in Hollywood and all these other things. But what's more, if I'm not mistaken, Jason, this whole little test run, as I'm calling it, came out of the Mercury Theater. Hint, hint, hint. And in the same way, I view this as a test to gather data after the fact about how people reacted. I think communism is a very similar thing. After all is said and done, we seem to be leaning towards or detecting that the so-called powers that be want to lean towards some form of weird communism. And when I talk to people like Fortune about what happened in Russia, that was guidelined from the top. So to get back to the point, I don't know how you feel about this, Jason, but to me, it was an intentional run so they could see what would the reaction be.
It's definitely very suspicious, but I don't know if there's any hardcore evidence that's been publicly released to say that it was a test run. But would that surprise me? Not in the least.
This is the beauty of Hollywood, right? They do all that they do, and it's all plausibly deniable. And most of it is plausibly deniable at a level that if you assert in the way I am now, you become a nutbag and a conspiracy person. But I'm sorry, I'm not buying. I look at the names and everything else around it, and it fits the bill. So, you know, how is it that he did this, supposedly caused all this upheaval? I think people were injured or something. What happened to him? They drag him up to the Senate and don't even bother to slap his wrist, or the Congress, I mean.
I am fairly confident, although again, there's no direct evidence to prove this, that something was up with Orson Welles because he was willing to play ball in a really big way with this early media empire that was forming. And it seemed like he was able to do whatever it was he wanted from that point.
It's crazy when you look at the accounts, and of course, some of those are Hollywood accounts. But if you look at other so-called producers and directors supposedly scratching to get their film made, here comes this guy in his very early 20s, not only getting to do the movie he wants, not only writing it the way he wants, but telling the studios to get out of his way and doing whatever he wants along the way. So there's clearly more to the story here.
World War II, which ran from 1939 until 1945, wasn't just a clash of armies. It was also a battle for minds. Psychological warfare became a legitimate and formal strategy, with nations deploying deception, propaganda, and interrogation techniques to outmaneuver enemies. The Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, was formed in 1942 under William Wild Bill Donovan. This was America's wartime intelligence agency, and it was tasked with espionage, sabotage, and cracking enemy secrets. Amid this high-stakes environment, the OSS turned to experimental methods, including drugs, to bend the human mind to their will. The OSS sought ways to loosen tongues and extract reliable intelligence from captured soldiers, spies, and defectors. Traditional interrogation, meaning threats and torture, would often yield lies or silence, so they began to explore pharmacology to bypass resistance. They employed the use of several drugs in their attempts. Marijuana was one, which was known then as marijuana or hashish, with the OSS testing various cannabis derivatives, believing its psychoactive effects could reduce inhibitions and make their subjects talkative or disoriented. Early trials used concentrated forms, sometimes smoked or injected. Another drug was scopolamine, which was a powerful alkaloid that is derived from nightshade plants, such as henbane. Scopolamine was already infamous in criminal circles as a knockout drug, and the OSS hoped its sedative and amnesiac properties could render prisoners compliant and truthful.
Kind of funny if you think about it. Back in the 40s, the OSS is using marijuana and hashish, which, by the way, is probably 10,000 times less potent than what's around today, I would imagine. I'm being facetious, but it's much more potent now. There was a time, and this was that time, when drugs were damn near unheard of in our culture and our society. They were there, but nowhere near what they were going to be. And it is my point of view that much of the drug epidemic that came was for social engineering. We know certainly, I think it's openly admitted, that crack was put into South Central LA by people with intent. The cocaine, much of the pot that came, all normalized now. And that was normalized just before my generation. I wasn't old enough to be a hippie, and it was really the hippie generation. So my parents' generation, the youngest of my parents' generation, or the oldest of my parents' generation, who would have been the people who began to normalize these drugs that are so commonplace now. From my point of view, we can see now how they got here, how it was normalized. But what's more, we can see what's come of it. When I was young, you had to sneak around to go find the pusher. Now, for many people, the pusher's at your nearest CVS. So it goes to show you, this is all social engineering from my point of view. Our music was affected by it. The way we tune our music was affected by it. The rise of communism was affected by it. And the normalization of drug use and the breaking of the family unit and rampant sexuality, which was a very different thing in our culture back then.
And for the last point for hour one, Operation TD, or Truth Drug. In secret facilities, such as Camp X in Canada or stateside OSS labs, agents administered the previously mentioned substances to volunteers, POWs, and suspected double agents. Marijuana was often given first to relax the subjects, which was followed by scopolamine to deepen suggestibility. Doses were imprecise, as sometimes it was smoked and sometimes taken as liquid extracts, which was paired with questioning under dim lights or sensory deprivation to heighten the effects. The OSS also tested hypnosis alongside the drugs, aiming to amplify compliance, which had mixed results at best. Marijuana made some chatty but incoherent. Scopolamine could induce a twilight state, where subjects might be inclined to mumble secrets, but it also caused confusion, hallucinations, or unconsciousness. One report described a prisoner revealing troop movements under scopolamine, only for the info to be unverifiable gibberish. Stanley Lovell, the OSS's chief of research and development, drove these efforts, dubbing them part of the Dirty Tricks toolkit. Lovell drew inspiration from rumors of Nazi drug experiments and pre-war medical studies on sedatives. Fear of Axis breakthroughs, like Germany's rumored use of mescaline or Japan's alleged opium-based interrogations, pushed the OSS to innovate. The urgency of the war trumped ethical concerns, and there was little regard for consent or long-term effects. Prisoners, of course, didn't volunteer for these tests, with drugs being administered covertly or coercively. This lack of agency is a hallmark of mind control, as subjects become tools, not participants, which is a precedent that would be echoed in post-war CIA programs in the next decade.
And human decency falls by the wayside. It becomes normalized to be that way, and then it becomes expected, and then it becomes demanded. And with all the work we've done, we could look back and we could say things like LSD was integrally introduced and one-to-one part of the Manson, Charles Manson made for TV skit. This has gone on and on and on. And in the same way that I have stated the problem with corporations, one of the big problems that I see is that they never hit the apex where they're doing the best they can do. And they say, all right, everyone back off. We found our perfect spot to operate from. Let's do this now. They always take it too far. So if you go all the way back into the 40s, when they're throwing human decency by the wayside, and then actually taking members of the place you said was the demon and copying things they did because you're worried they're going to be ahead of you, and yet you're calling them the demon, and you sacrifice all human decency, which direction is that going to go in the places of power over the next decades? Well, we've seen it. We come to now, where free speech, human decency, just all of it, all the decent aspects of culture crumbling down around us. And this is the big difference in my mind between the mind sciences that is well represented in India and what's going on here with psychology, the science-based version of the mind sciences. One of them lives and dies under the idea of spiritual concerns and human decency, and the other one doesn't know a line where they should quit. As a matter of fact, there seems to be no line. If they think they can achieve the outcome, then it doesn't matter what they do to get there. Anyhow, Jason, you want to add anything?
Well, we ain't seen nothing yet, because once we get into the 1950s and into the later 20th century, we're going to see, especially with the CIA, just how much human decency doesn't even freaking exist.
I mean, in some ways, I don't even feel like I can completely speak my mind when we cover a topic like this, because if I'm going to be absolutely open and honest, which I will be, but I will limit what I say because I don't need all the poison pen mail. We have been conditioned from cradle to grave, at least in my lifespan, from 1963 to now, from our entertainment, from our movies, from the things we're expected to do to get along in society, to the education we had, to the drug, just all of it has been aspects of social engineering. And when we look back at where this supposedly started, where are we going to? Well, we're going to go to Sigmund Freud, and then we're going to start eyeballing his nephew on whatever it was, Fifth Avenue in New York, where marketing is going to take off and become something new. And I'll tell you another thing. If people said to me, you're crazy, what you just said is nonsense, try this one on for size. Christmas is completely brought to you by marketing, and it is completely a morphing of pagan ideals. 100%, by the way. But with that, we're going to wrap up hour one of episode 628. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode, and they get access to all the forums and comments section. They can create new topics, top-level ideas. They can also stream the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon anytime. That covers all my older telescope work, lunar waves, UFOs. By the way, I will be playing some of my old school clips, some of which were never published, as I do the members-only solar videos that are available to members-only on the site. Also available is my still work that I have done with the solar telescope. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back for hour two, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. I hope to see you logged in for hour two. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.